Okay.
Welcome back to Bibliosynensis.
Hi, Hauntiers and Bibliophiles. This is episode 2 of...
I don't know how many episodes we have, we're just going to keep going.
Yeah. Basically, until we run out of subjects.
There you go.
Or we just run out of ourselves.
Oh my goodness. That's a terrible idea. But hey, here we are.
Okay. Well, I hope you enjoyed the previous episode. We talked about book pacing and how many books you carry in your arsenal at a time and how do you interchange. And we had a whole episode on that and literary synergy, which was really fascinating. So if you missed that, please check it out. But today's subject is actually going to be regarding collecting books.
Yay!
Yeah, and I can tell Eugene's actually really getting on this subject. Eugene's quite the book collector.
I think.
But we're going to talk about what kind of books you collect, how you collect books, what does the average reader collect, so on and so forth. And are any of those things valuable? So stay tuned and we'll get started.
I guess we could just kind of begin with the article you found.
So I guess I try to find sources that are out there.
Yeah.
And in this case, I was able to find two interesting articles. Well, not articles. One of them's actually a list, and I thought we would go over that. I will have that available on the blog. This is actually on Goodreads.com, which is a wonderful source if you're an avid reader. I'm sure you readers out there use it. I use it religiously. When I run into a bookstore, I'm always constantly scanning the want to read section of my library, and it keeps track of my currently read or to read, and it's a great resource. So the list I got was the best-selling books of all time, and they have the top 100. I was actually not too surprised of the first top 5, except for the last one, which I hadn't really heard much of, but that might just be a cultural thing. We have The Tale of Two Cities, believe it or not, as number 1 on the list, that with Charles Dickens.
Really weird.
Followed by Lord of the Rings, books 1 through 3, The Little Prince, The Hobbit, and Dream of the Red Chamber from Xiaowen Kao, I want to say.
Wait, The Prince as in Machiavelli?
No, The Little Prince.
Oh, The Little Prince.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, I mean, those are the top 5. Then it follows, if you want to hear the next 6 through 10, you have an Agatha Christie. And then There Were None, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis. She, A History Adventure by H. Rider Haggard, and The Da Vinci Code actually comes in with Dan Brown at 9. And then I thought it was interesting, because then it shifts over from, like, storytelling aspect books to Think and Grow Rich, the landmark bestseller, now revised and updated for the 21st century.
Interesting.
So those are the top 10. I could keep going. I mean, Catcher in the Rye's right under it, The Alchemist, so on and so forth.
Okay.
But
this is of all time.
Of all time. So I actually thought it was really interesting. I could have sworn Don Quixote would be somewhere up on the top.
I would have expected the Bible somewhere, because everyone's always comparing. Like, it sold more copies than the Bible.
Right. And I also read that Don Quixote, out of all books of all time next to the Bible in terms of literature...
Yeah.
It sold 500 million copies, so
right.
I'm surprised it's not on the list, but one pattern I did notice on this list is it's a lot of classic storytelling.
That's so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, when I actually was researching, like, I think about 5 years ago, over what books were the top 10 in each country, because mm-hmm. I was trying to research per English-speaking country, including Australia, Canada, you know, Great Britain, and America, North America, USA, hi. It was always Pride and Prejudice.
Hmm. You know, Let me see what Pride and Prejudice, if it lands on this
I would list. Be really surprised if it didn't land
on this list. Let's take a look.
Like, did people just get tired of, like, you know, Elizabeth and Darcy actually talking to each other? I mean, like, did people realize that Darcy was actually a real jerk? I mean, that's just me as a dude. I mean, well, on the other sense, like, did they realize, or rather, did they get tired of Elizabeth's sisters and mom actually just being gold diggers? I mean, I've heard a lot of people try to summarize the story, to be honest, but I think the best summary I've ever heard was probably, there was this one, like, series where, like, they had a bunch of, like, rappers explain summaries of each book.
Like, would you believe that it didn't make this list?
I am in disbelief.
Yeah.
Why? Why? Oh god, why?
Best-selling books of all time. I mean, to be fair, I just finished reading Austen's biography, and a lot of her books actually tanked.
Oh, that's so awkward.
Like, they were doing really well, but, like, near the end of her career, a few of them did tank.
I understand that, but why now of all time?
I mean, maybe because in the first half, it wasn't selling? Who knows?
Okay.
I think that's fascinating.
Are we going by, like, was it just selling when they got, you know, they were just released? Or are we talking
this
about...
This is of all time.
This is so awkward.
And this is of all time.
Why? Why? I mean, why? All right, just, I guess, let's just kind of chill, maybe. Maybe this will help. We're going to pour ourselves some tea.
Okay.
Please, carry on.
Well, let's talk about the tea.
Ooh, alright, let's talk.
So, again, this is a tea spectral tea. I wonder if you can hear us pouring that lovely brew, but, this episode we chose Phoenix.
Phoenix.
So, Phoenix is one of my favorite afternoon pick-me-up teas. It's actually a oolong. It's probably at this current recording one of the only oolongs that are in the shop. It's a really dark amber oolong, and it's mixed with some light, delicate fruit notes, that nice, light, uplifting lemongrass, and then there's a little bite from a lemon peel.
Now, a lot of people were associating this with Harry Potter whenever they brought up this tea for some reason. I guess it was probably...
Well, Order of the Phoenix.
Yeah. Like, I guess they just wanted to represent somehow.
I named it Phoenix because of the contrast in it. It's something dark and smoldery, which is like an oolong. It's very... I wouldn't say it's smoky, but it's got like a really deep woody note, but it's mixed with like light and uplifting.
Okay, so it doesn't, like, describe anything like Fox actually burning up in front of Harry Potter. And just.
I mean, I could get that visual.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
All right, that's cool.
I also love it because it's just kind of like an easygoing, light pick-me-up. And, I mean, when I talk about my book collection, to me, there's nothing more uplifting than that. Because I find that even in our private lives, even talking to our friends at parties and such, the subject always comes up.
Which one?
What books you collect, how you collect them.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm guilty of using the hashtag shelfie. Like, your shelf and showing off my book collection. It's quite impressive.
I feel awkward about, my books sometimes because I feel almost like the real book readers are not on social media half the time.
Because... Have you heard of the flatlay movement?
No.
So on Instagram, it's actually a really popular flatlaying is basically you take a picture of things scattered on your table and you take a picture from above and it kind of looks like a diagram or a chart. But there's a ton of book readers, and if they're about to review a book, they do a flat lay. Right. And I know a few of them. Shout out to Clockwork Book Dragon. She's been a loyal follower of T-Spectral for so long. Aww. But she does the most amazing book flatlays. And she is, like, one of, if I know anyone, like, one of the top supporters of indie novelists. Like, she buys them their books off of Amazon and does reviews and promotes them. And it's phenomenal. But they're there. I just think they're a very specific niche.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I mean, like, I guess I work a lot more with boomers, you know? I mean, I've worked at a bookstore before, and right now I'm working at a publishing shop, and a lot of the times when I get to actually meet somebody with an actual list, I'm talking about, like, a list, like, their own, you probably haven't heard of, you know, half of the stuff that they put in there. Because a lot of the times when you try to talk to somebody that says, yes, I read, they usually are just talking about the popular stuff.
Hmm.
And sometimes they don't even know what they're talking about because it's just popular. You could obviously Wikipedia the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these people, when they actually, meet them,
mm-hmm.
they're always offline. It's like a weird society of, like, I guess 1970s and 1960s readers
mm-hmm.
that just were there when, like, I guess the book publishing industry just boomed mm-hmm. during their, I guess, recession. Their recession. It wasn't, like, our Great Recession. It was just their problem coming back from, like, war and hippie stuff. Like, they had a language.
Well, I'd like to elaborate on that, actually, with the subject at hand. All right. Because, for those of you that do not know, Eugene actually worked at a bookstore. It was one of his first jobs here that wasn't, like, a consultation or a contractor job, oh, right?
Yes.
It was a traveling bookshop, right?
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, because I've never worked at a bookshop, I'm wondering what kind of books people collected. What did you see that was often popular? What kind of habits? Like, could you see someone walk in and were they, like, a stereotype enough to know exactly what they would buy?
Everybody that comes into a bookshop knows exactly what they want to buy. But once they enter a bookshop, they didn't realize that there were selections. It's an awkward thing to always experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because not only was I... It was a weird job. Like, not only was I setting up the pop-up store,
mm-hmm.
like, every morning and cleaning it, and I had to actually do the inventory, like, right before, like, you know, the doors open.
Mm-hmm.
I also was taking care of the inventory online. So half the time, I was actually being paid as a web designer. And I had to actually come to terms that there were two types of readers. Hmm. And you could tell over who reads and who doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that don't read will always ask for Shakespeare. Because that's what they know. That's what they were taught.
Is it almost, would you say, like a rites of passage? Like, even till now, one of my graduation gifts was from my friend, like, a giant, the cheesy volume of, I'm looking at it right now, William Shakespeare's The Complete Works,
mm-hmm.
and it's got, like, a cheesy inscription in it, like, from a writer to a writer, some nonsense, but a friend of mine gave it to me.
Right.
I kid you not, I probably have cracked that book open, like, 4 times in my life, even though I'm going back through, you know, Shakespeare's writing.
Right.
It just... You know, is it just a rite of passage? Is it just something, like, you need to have on your bookshelf?
As an American reader, mm-hmm. yes, because you would look like an idiot.
Okay, well, because... I guess I look pretty cool then.
Yeah, because everybody that knows anything about entertainment will at least hear Shakespeare once in their life, okay? It's gonna happen, you know? But the problem is, people only remember the 4 comedies and the 4 tragedies. And that's as far as their list goes. And you having the collection here, you actually are going through the rest of Shakespeare's works, which is more character-based than story-based. My apologies. That was actually our dog. Where, Ozis, that is That is Arabella.
Arabella.
Yes.
Which, kudo points to anyone that knows what book that's from.
Oh boy, that's going to be a tough one. she's our newest puppy, so she's playing with our parents right now, so do apologize if you actually get to hear her, and yeah. Let's go right ahead and continue anyways. The issue with Shakespeare is that a lot of people don't know that Shakespeare was kind of playing more with, I guess, like, series. Mm-hmm. Like, if you go further into Shakespeare's works, he wanted to actually make episodes. He wanted to make episodes.
Yeah, so one of the reasons why I did pick up that big volume was because I was so curious to find out exactly, like, okay, I hear about the four comedies and the four tragedies, but what else is there? I mean, it's a huge book.
Yeah.
You know? And some of the plots on those things, they're horrible.
Yeah.
There's a lot of rape in Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Good Lord, I thought there was a lot of murder in Shakespeare. No, 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 no. There was also pregnancies and rape and drugs.
Good times.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was very political in that sense. Mm-hmm. Personally, I'm more of a Marlowian, Elizabethan reader, because I love his works. They sound exactly like Shakespeare, but, you know, if you know anything about the theory that Shakespeare didn't exist, there were four authors that actually were contending as the possible Shakespeare writer. There were, like, theories that one of them was a duke, the other one was, I guess, collaborating, or rather they were all collaborating. Who knows? Just, there were theories about Shakespeare. But nevertheless, let's go right ahead and get back to the issue of the other reader.
Yeah. Which
I felt like is the real gateway to knowing if the person is a real reader or okay. if they're just buying it.
So, you have a customer.
Yes.
They come in.
Right.
And how do you know the real reader? Is there the avid reader?
The avid reader? Okay, that's digging a little deeper, but I'm...
Okay, let's start with the actual reader. Like, a person that
Yeah, the reads actual reads.
And would purchase for the sake of reading.
The person that would actually, that actually is a reader, are the ones that buy a Jane Austen book.
Is that why you brought up Jane Austen?
I have to, because everybody that actually reads has a Jane Austen book. Personally, we talked about Regency writing versus Victorian writing last time.
Last episode, right?
Yeah. And I have met so many Regency collectors. And I know, like, there must have been more than Jane Austen that actually collected at the bookshop. You know, I wasn't always at the bookshop. We took shifts, you know, part-timers. But either way, like, we were able to actually figure out if they wanted more. I was just, like, enamored by the fact that they could actually hold a bibliophile conversation. They would start talking about, like, their embarrassment that they've read a Nicholas Sparks book, and they collect them, and they would cry, you know, every time they'd read them. And even, like, they even had a story where they were on an airplane ride, and at the end of the book, they couldn't stop sobbing.
Aww.
But the embarrassing situation is, she actually... You know, said reading a Nicholas Sparks book was hard. It's really hard because it's really bad writing.
Hmm.
You know, but I love the content. He makes it engaging enough. I understand. I have read The Vampire Lestat, and I feel the same way about Anne Rice. It is so hard to get through her writing because it feels like. You have to be a weeb to read her stuff.
Do you want to enlighten people what a weeb is?
Oh my goodness. Imagine a dweeb, but they're like half as, you know, coherent. That's what a weeb is. They love anime. They treat anime as if it was their lifestyle, and they insult the Japanese culture by pretending that they can speak Japanese. You know, like, saying, like, a few words, you know, from a drama does not actually make you a coherent speaker of the language.
So if you're looking for a dark rabbit hole to go down on YouTube, just look up Weeboo.
Oh, goodness.
W-E-E-B-O-O-O. I'm sure most of you already know about it if you're involved in you know, the con scene or whatever.
Exactly.
But I'm sure you have one in your life. They're kind of hard to miss these days. It's right. like a cultural phenomenon, but we're not here for that.
Right. But the thing is, that the weird guilt I have is that I do get through Anne Rice's book, and I do like her stories. It's just... Oh, the writing.
So I'm not going to lie, that's probably me and Mark Twain. Like, okay. I want to love him so bad, and I love the research that he puts into his work. I mean, right now, I'm currently reading his version of The Prince and the Pauper.
Right.
And, whoo, it is what it is. I don't know how to explain it.
No, it's understandable.
If any of you are interested in the one-off book reviews, let me know. Yeah. Because it's definitely not your popular vote.
Yeah, but, not a popular opinion there.
That would probably be most of our book titles on our shelves. I mean, most because likely. That's something we can talk about right now that's interesting is we share a bookshelf.
Yeah.
We recently had to downsize. So if a little backstory, I mean, most of you know that this podcast is actually sponsored by Tea Spectral. And that's the tea company that both of us share. But we've had to convert one of our bookshelves entirely to the tea business. And then we bring it to the factory to mix and yada yada. Or we store the ones that are to be mailed out. But we've kind of have this mini warehouse action. So it's literally, like, I'm sitting here literally in the corner and I'm literally looking at one shelf, which is tea, and one shelf, which is books, like, or tea and books. So, I mean, that's literally our office. And here we are right smack in the middle recording this podcast. So I guess that if there was any a truer sound to the words bibliosinensis, that is literally the description of the office which we sit in and do this. But we would fight. Most of our biggest fights when we first moved in with each other was the bookshelf, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
We just got married. The closet was easy, you know?
Like clothes.
Yeah, our clothes were fine.
I think
fine.
We had less problems with clothes.
With clothes, yeah. If anything, it was the books that was heartbreaking. Like, her bookshelf was already full. My bookshelf was moving in.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not have enough space. I have this habit that I think is normal, but she actually gets really irritated that I, you know, vertically and horizontally stack my books just to fit it in the shelf. Like, I don't care if it actually is pleasant to see. I will stack some, you know, I will fit that book somewhere. I will squeeze it in. And I know to some book collectors, that's status. That is status. I'm not sure if I can actually convince Steph, but
nope,
it is.
You can't
it's,
convince
it's
me.
An actual status.
We're already at 3-layer stack on each shelf.
Yes.
Like, in rows.
And I had to actually donate half of my collection to the library.
And so did I.
And I still have a third more in my suitcase.
Oh, yes. We still have some in the suitcase, and I also have some stored in the closet.
Yeah, I know.
So...
heartbreaking.
It's rough. Another thing I had to end up doing, which I guess is an interesting subject, but I bought both of us e-readers as a gift for Christmas. And I started to take some classics that we had or some easy ones, and I made a huge download collection on each of our different
e-readers,
which is how I was able to cut back on some of the books.
Yeah.
Now, Eugene has an interesting hobby, and I thought it was just him, but... our friends actually got into this conversation on my birthday, and it's about collecting your favorite book over and over.
Oh, yeah. It's a real hobby.
So, tell me about this.
Oh, okay. Well, let me tell you. basically, there's this book that you love. You just love. It could be...
Which one is it for you? Because I know which one it is.
Okay, yeah. For me, it's Oscar Wilde. I collect the picture of Dorian Gray over and over, and Beowulf. Now, there's a difference between recollecting Oscar Wilde books, because there's no new books on Oscar Wilde, you know? It's always the same book. It's just a different cover. It's just a different publisher. And when a publisher makes the book, you enjoy the craft that they put into assembling it, you know, from the binding to the paper that they actually used for the pages. And there's like, you know, there's that new book smell, and then there's also that old book smell. There are like, there were book societies that would publish their own private collection, and they would certify it with their society's, like, you know, stamp on it. And there would be only like, what, 200 of them available in the entire world? So they would make like gold leaf papers and like leather bound that had like maybe 3 to 4 layers of design. You know, you would find like these gold inlays and lacquer finishes, or like some of them would be like straight up wood. You know, they would just be like gorgeous. And that's what I do. You know, that's what I like to do.
That's your thing.
But then there's the Beowulf collection, which I'm surprised that people were surprised by this. The first book of Beowulf that everyone's introduced to is usually the Christian version. The Christian version of Beowulf is, you know, usually comes in like this really, you know, small novelette book by Dover. And it's usually like a knight trying to fend off a dragon. Now, here's the thing. Like, that version was written by, you know, Christian authors and editors. And it would always go under the verse that it was always a Christian, you know, story. I know. Now, there is this one other book that even I see in movies and, like, television shows when they actually show their collection. And that's always the Beowulf written by, or translated by, Seamus Heaney. Which, on the left side, is in the original written language. And on the right side is written in English.
Is that the one with the chainmail that you have?
Yes.
The black and white paperback with a chainmail on it.
It's a hardcover with a dust jacket. Yes.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. Like, to me, that is a treasure. I mean, like, I get it. You could buy it at Barnes & Noble anytime. Anytime. But it is a beautiful book. You can follow the poetry in its syntax, in its rhyme, in its rhythm. And it's just fantastic. It gives you a really good understanding of the story itself. And then there's the last one, which was written by J.R.R. Tolkien.
Like the commentary or
both?
Authored? Oh.
Okay. He translated the book. He had no intention of publishing it. You know, like, thank God we have his son, because he's publishing everything else. Like, if it weren't for his son, we wouldn't have the Silmarillion. If it weren't for his son, we wouldn't have his Beowulf book. This book has, you know, both his commentary and his version of the translation. And it is a beautiful blue book. I'd suggest you try to get it sometime, because it is just amazing to have. But the last version of the Beowulf that I want to collect was written by Neil Gaiman himself. If you guys have seen the animated movie, the 3D one, with you know, with Beowulf being practically like shirtless most of the time, it is more of a revision than the usual, than the actual book.
Wasn't that his claim to fame in terms of directing? Because I remember earlier in his career, he was heavily interviewed for that movie.
I guess so. I guess it was like his American fame to direct it. Because he did that with, he's also directed in the Neverwhere movie.
Right.
Oh, wait, it wasn't a movie. That's right, it was actually a series.
So, anyways, but about this book.
Yeah, about the book. The book is like, you know, you have Grendel, and you have the dragon. And Grendel is, you know, supposed to be the son of the dragon, and they are killed by Beowulf.
Hmm.
Now, in the movie, Grendel is the son of Hrothgar, the chieftain they actually meet first. And then the dragon is Beowulf's son.
Hmm.
As cool as it was, it wasn't the Beowulf we grew up with. But at least, hey, we got to see, like, you know, Grendel's arm being cut off, and the dragon that actually kills everybody. It was cool. Mm-hmm. It was cool. At least, also, he did it justice in the transition of the story of Beowulf going from the old ways and into Christianity. You know, that makes total sense. Because the thing is...
Yeah, go ahead.
The thing is, like, Tolkien actually was one of the first few people that said, maybe Beowulf isn't real. Maybe Beowulf is actually just a work of fiction.
Hmm.
You know? We never had real dragons. That kind of deal. So, it's a beautiful thing to kind of collect. It's not hard to collect, to be honest, because not too many people really publish too many Beowulf books. And it's usually just the usual, you know, those usual four that you just gotta look for.
Well, what I find interesting is it's almost like you are collecting the same book, but you're not, because they're translated by different authors.
Yeah, but that's like collecting all the Robin Hood and King Arthur books.
So I'm actually a King Arthur collector. I mean, I don't religiously collect, but I do have... I have Steinbeck, which was a gift from Eugene, and it is a first edition. It's also... I actually have the newspaper review article clipping as the bookmark when we purchased it. And I mentioned earlier, I have the Rosalind Miles. I have the classic one. I have the Tennyson books. I love The Green Knight. Yeah.
For those of you that don't know what it's like to collect... King Arthur books, there's so many rewritten versions of it. There's
way too many.
Yeah, too many. Like, there is a lore for just King Arthur, in, you know, by himself. Like, let's not even touch Lancelot. Let's not even touch, you know, Guinevere. Like, let's not even touch Gawain. Like, it goes on.
Mm-hmm.
It just goes on. And it's been rewritten so much, and usually, like, and the thing is that you gotta understand is, usually these books were rewritten because there was a time of need for that kind of icon to return,
right.
You know? And a lot of it, I think, was actually out of political changes,
mm-hmm.
You know? So, in that, I guess, I'd like to ask about some of your collections.
Okay.
You actually have a rare book called Alice in Underland.
Yes, I have a few rare books, actually. I have the original publication of the sketchbook.
Mm-hmm.
I have the first edition of The Thief Lord.
Right.
What else do I have? Well, I don't know. I don't really... brag about what I have. I know I'm really grateful. I have a publication of Samuel Pepys' diary.
Yeah.
That is so hard to find in America.
Yeah.
For those of you who don't know, Samuel Pepys was of the court during King Charles II's reign.
Yeah.
To me, that's really important because that was the time that tea was actually introduced into Britain, and tea culture as we know it happened.
It was because King Charles II had a Portuguese queen.
Yes, and she drank nothing but tea.
And the problem was the entire court drank nothing but beer.
Yeah, so they had to import it, and that was the beginning of kind of enlightenment and talking about coffee houses and, you know, I think... at that time, it was so fascinating. Like, when you walked into a coffee shop back in the day, you could have your tea or your coffee, but you were able to basically be equal. Like, there's a common saying that you could literally be a highwayman on the road, or you could be a nobleman. But you can meet at a coffee house and talk politics. And it was so cool. But Pepys kept accounted, like, a very detailed diary every day about what he was doing, what people were doing, what people ate. And it's one of the most valuable of that era's recollections of literature, because we learned a lot about just the daily and how politics actually worked.
And how people were doing on their, you know, on their daily grind.
Oh, yes. So, spilling the tea, Pepys was probably the master of that, because any gossip that would
happen,
he confessed, or he would write notes of,
like, in his diary. Like, if this guy had a Twitter account, he would be in paradise.
No, he'd be more like TMZ.
Yeah, he would be.
Yeah.
And just to give you guys an understanding over when this guy actually was alive, it was this around the same time as Marie Antoinette, was it? No. Mm-mm. No, it was not. Oh, it was not. It was way before. It was way before Georgian era.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess, what type of king was there? King Louis... It must have been, like, the second. It was, like... I think it was, like, the Sun King, wasn't it?
I'm not sure. All I know is it's definitely around drawing a blank.
I know, right? It's somewhere, like, there. It was
when the Pilgrims happened.
A lot of things changed back in those days.
Because, Puritans. It was during the Puritan revolts.
Exactly. So. It was actually during the time when they just passed a law that no man could actually act as a woman in theater. Wasn't that it?
Yes, it was around that time. If you ever heard of the movie Stage Beauty with Claire Danes in it, it is a phenomenal movie. It's actually one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Go watch it. And Pepys actually makes an appearance in Stage Beauty. So, there you have it.
Yeah.
So, I have Pepys. I have The Sketchbook, which is another collection of musings for a person's journey. I think it's a Washington Irving. You can pick it up right there. It's right behind you. I have, like, a vintage book stash. So, yes, it is a Washington Irving book. And it is the illustrated edition. And it looks like this was dedicated to Shiloh Olay on October 3rd, and it even says AD 1882. And I have that pen inscription right here in it. It's something that's just incredibly special for me. And I love it.
Yeah, just to let you guys know, we do some treasure hunting.
Yeah. Oh, my spine.
I know.
Book
doctors are hard to find nowadays.
I will definitely take a picture of this book and put it on the website for everyone to see.
Yeah.
I know one thing that kind of started my obsession in terms of books, and I'm sure you noticed it, is I collect a lot of children's books. And not your typical children's books. I collect a lot of, like, kind of... I look for children's books that kind of discuss rites of passage. That's something very personable for me. And a lot of my books are also very sentimental. I mean, one of my favorite books I actually have on the shelf is a really tattered version of The Crucible. And it was actually gifted to me in high school. Somebody got it at a used library books sale and gave it to me, and then we went and watched the school play together, and that was really, really something personal to me, because it was a gift book. So, I have a lot of those. On the blog, we're actually going to be releasing a blog post on our top five. So, you get to see me and Eugene's top five at the moment on personal sentimental collections and the stories that happen with those books. But anyways.
Don't visit my Goodreads account. It's so outdated.
Unlike Eugene, though, my Goodreads is religiously updated. So do follow mine, we'll have a link to that on our blog as well, which is at bibliosinensis.com.
I find it kind of awkward that when we're on Goodreads, we never, ever follow the discussion events.
Don't even get me started.
I mean, I feel weird because, like, I read because I enjoy the written stuff, but I feel like when you go into those discussions, it's almost like half gossip, or if not all gossip. You know, they wanted to know, like, the tidbits about the author. They want to know, like, they treat them like Hollywood celebrities, I guess. Which is okay if you're that kind of person. But when you're collecting books, you're more of an intuitive reader, and you'd rather hear or rather read a complete understanding of what the author is like and what the author wants to be known for. I don't know. Do you ever get that? Like,
I do. Yeah. I just feel like it could be a little more organized, but I'm not going to go there.
Okay.
I am going to go back to that strange Goodreads top bestsellers of all time list. And the reason why I wanted to bring it up is because we've been going back and forth, I did notice a theme. Like I said earlier, a lot of them are storytelling books. Mm. A lot of them are novels, fantasy, and children books and so forth. Do you think people in general are just drawn to them as stories, or do you think they're just collectible because they're good gift books? Like, what would you think?
Well, working at a bookstore, I'm just going to let you know that books are reprinted with different book covers, with different editions, and it's all for the sake of the sale. I mean, you usually just make one giant order for, like, that edition that you actually, you know, try to put in, you know, these bookstores. And it's usually just that collection. By the time that you get to the next edition, it might be the second, might be the third, you know, might be the 10th or the 200th. I don't, you know, it doesn't matter. Just, they will actually come with this one thing that people don't realize is kind of important at their publication.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually the acknowledgement and foreword. You know, you get people that are like famous authors to kind of say, yes, I enjoyed this book and this is my take on it. You know, here's an essay, blah, blah, blah. You know, like, they always add something, like a little bit of here, a little bit there, a new illustration, or some sort of form that makes it more precious than the last one. And people actually, they need that. You know, they want to actually have it be republished because it's how you actually keep that book alive.
So, I'm not gonna lie, in that tune, I specifically bought a copy of Treasure Island just for the foreword. It was a foreword written by, I can never say his name, Eon Colfer,
okay.
Who's the author of Artemis Fowl. They're about to make a movie.
The previews have already been out.
So. Yes, and they look amazing. But, he's such an advocate for, like, adventure stories and young adult, that sort of thing. And I specifically got, like, I like Treasure Island.
Right.
But it was just extra special to have it from them because I felt like it was two generations melding together and I loved it so much. So I still have that copy, even though it's just a paperback.
Yeah. Oh, that's perfect. That's perfect. That's why you also found The 13th Tale, wasn't it?
Oh, goodness. 13th Tale is phenomenal. But no, I found that at a bargain book.
Oh, which book was it that you actually found through a review?
I found, which, this is a hint going out to our earlier question. I found it because Neil Gaiman actually wrote a review for Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. And I was just absolutely intrigued. It's so well written. I don't know. I don't want to go into too much detail about it, but if you're looking for a book that will seriously keep you entertained for years, and I literally mean years, go get this book. It is a fantasy novel set during the Regency era, and it is during the Napoleonic War. And they actually find out that magic is still alive in England. And there's a prophecy from this infamous fairy king called the Raven King that needs to be fulfilled. And they hire two magicians that are still learning to be magicians and even what the theory of magic or how magic works in general, because it's revived back in England. And they put them in the war. So it's everything you can imagine. It's fantasy. It's magic. It's and it's history. And all of it is written in a narrative, but also textbook formats. And just...
And the thing is, the story is parallel to history.
It is parallel to history. It is so fascinating how they did it. It was so intelligent and well-written. It's written by Suzanne Clark. I can't recommend enough the series on Netflix. I'm guilty of watching it twice, maybe three times in a row. It's such a good show.
Spoken like a true fan.
Yes, I am a diehard fan of this book series. I need to get on to The Ladies of Grace Adieu, which is the accompanying book, believe it or not. It's a side story to this universe, but yes, it is phenomenal.
Okay.
I guess I should move on to our second and our last article. And I thought this would be a fun thing to talk about because you're a collector, I'm a collector. This goes into the world, roughly, of rare book collecting, which you're slightly familiar with. I'm a little familiar with just because I'm an art history, prior art history major. And book collecting has a lot to do with the culture. So I found this article on Forbes. It was written March of last year, 2019. And the author is David Seidman. He is normally a financial writer. But he wrote, "Are Your Used Books Worth Anything?" the article actually starts with him talking about going to heritage auctions where a Scott Fitzgerald's Great Gatsby from 1925 that was signed and inscribed as a first edition sold for $162,500 in a rare book sale. So, if that doesn't tell you the value, I don't know what does, but it's one of those most sought out. Anyways, this article goes into telling us some tips on finding pricey books, and I wanted to go over it because it tells you first the no demands and then what is in high demand. So are you ready?
Ready.
And let's see how our collection ends up. Or maybe those of you that are listening at home, maybe think about what collections, like what's in your collection that might add up. Who knows? Okay, let's start with the no demand. Oh, this is going to kill you.
Okay.
The first thing they mention is beware of book club editions.
That's understandable.
They're often mistaken for first editions.
They're not.
And they are the equivalent of rookie sports cards in terms of collection value. So do you have any Reader Digest or book club type books? I know actually got you one.
Yeah, it's the poems of John Keats, one of my favorites.
And why did you get it?
Not only does it have a leather bounding with a gold inlay on the the book cover, it has a lithograph. Oh, is this a page like for both the front and back binding?
Mm-hmm.
It has cotton pages with gold, just leaflets on the, you know, on the corners.
Mm-hmm.
And it has old illustrations with a certification, along with, I guess, a subscription to the club itself.
I love when you pick this book up. FYI, for any of you haunteers out there, these are the books I actually take pictures on the tea, with the tea on them, because they're so aesthetically pleasing. And I use them for the photo shoots, but definitely this one's one of them. And if you open the inlay, it has this gorgeous, like, silk satin, like, inbounding to it. And it's, like, this beautiful dusty pink. So.
And for those that kind of want to find these, like, you know, beautiful collections, they're usually found in used bookstores. Like, I get it. Some people actually, like, snob these stores off because, ew, these books have been written on. Or, ew, you know, they're just dusty and all that. But you don't realize what they collect in the used bookstores. They're not just, like, a junkyard for, you know, like, forgotten books. They are actual books that mean something to collectors. It's not the fact that the used bookstores have actually, you know, lost their touch and why, like, there's so many books but not so many sales as it seems like. Okay, mm-hmm. because there are a lot of sales happening. Mm-hmm. It's just the generation that used to value these books are just dying off. And what are we going to do? We're going to go ahead and say, like, I don't know, a Louis L'Amour collection is just going to sit there for ages. Why? You don't like cowboys? Like, have you guys actually read these cowboy novels? They're actual good romance for dudes. For dudes. A lot of people don't realize that there were a lot of romantic readers that were male. But obviously you'd only find ones for girls. You know, soap operas were the big thing back in those days. And guys loved to actually think about the romantic hero that would cherish the ladies. So, anyways.
Shall we move on?
Yes, please.
So these were two interesting things, since you're talking about lost generations.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to combine these two together because I think they're both relevant to each other. The other one, or number one of the two, is Forget Family Bibles, Almanacs, and Encyclopedias.
Mm.
There is virtually no market for them. And encyclopedias are disposable.
Well, that's only thanks to the internet now. Mm-hmm. I mean,
oh, and so the second one is almost anything printed after 1970 is not valuable because of the internet flooding the market and causing a crash.
I kind of disagree. I mean, you go right ahead and try to find me a Liavec series online.
Nobody knows what Liavec is.
Right. Liavec, as Steph found on her own, is this gorgeous, like, book series by different authors of their time.
And they would create this own world. But the fascinating thing about the Liavec is most of those people from the 70s moved on to be producers on, like, Star Trek, Stargate, a lot of sci-fi, like, shows. A lot of them appear on Comic-Con panels even till now. So they would practice their craft when they were still in college, publishing for Liavec.
Yeah.
And there's, like, no way of finding these books, I can tell you now, like.
They were always paperback.
The only edition available I have at the moment cost me, like, $20 for this beat-up paperback on Amazon. But I actually found them through a Masterpiece collection of short stories. But amazing work, by the way.
And with the pop-up bookstore I was working at, I just gotta let you know, like, you can't find half of this online. Like, the generation that collected these are dead.
But this is anything printed after 1970s.
What happens to the boxcar, you know, children? Yeah. Or
Babysitter's
Club. Babysitter's Club, yeah.
Or Goosebumps. This one's gonna hurt, because we save used books.
Right.
Any first editions missing their dust jackets?
I totally understand that.
They are instantly...
Yeah, because done. The minute you lose the dust jacket, their novelty disappears. If you've seen half of these books that were first edition, they usually look like their plainest ever, you know? Usually don't get the really nice ones until afterwards.
Forged signed books apparently is a problem.
Yeah. Ooh, that happens a lot with scripts.
Apparently, a very famous author is like Stephen King gets forged all the time.
Yeah.
So you need to have the article with you or the pamphlet. So... I know we always bring this up, but for Eugene's birthday one year, we did go to a Neil Gaiman talk, and I do have a few autographed books from him from the event, and I keep the programs within the book so that they keep their value.
Thank you for that.
But there you go.
Yeah.
Let's see. Covers highlighting prizes. So anything saying, like, bestseller or Pulitzer Prize, anything like that
is not of no value. Well, I guess that makes sense.
I think that would show that it's, like, a second edition.
Oh,
wouldn't it? Because you would have to have it published first and then get the award and then put that sort of stuff on the cover.
Yeah.
So there's something.
Yeah, there's something.
Let's see. All right, well, that's everything not in demand. Are you ready for in demand?
Ready.
All right, is inscribed first editions by famous authors.
Inscribed?
Mm-hmm.
Like, they wrote, like, something on it?
Yes.
Okay.
Which is interesting, because one of them is a John Steinbeck.
Oh.
And I think I do have a... John Steinbeck, so I'll have to look into that. Apparently, this says it's worth between $1,000 to $1,500. Okay. So,
word of advice: always check A Books, because their price fluctuate like the stock market. Like, I did not know Louis L'Amour was actually still in demand, and you know his full collection as. Beautiful as they were in hardcover, leather bound, was only still worth like $80. That was heartbreaking, but there was still an offer on the table. Now, you go right ahead and find like we found like, I think a 1700s book, but because nobody knew what that title was, nobody wanted to collect it. So the value just kind of went down. No demand. Like, it made sense if it had some demand to actually keep a price on it, but without a demand, it was locked in our vault.
Interesting. So, another thing he mentions is inscriptions with content will raise value. So, anything where the author signs it and mentions, like, a charity that it was about or a memo will instantly raise the value.
That's interesting, because you have a collection of Frank Bedour books, but were they inscribed to you, or was it...
They are actually... Okay, so a little backstory on those.
Mm-hmm.
If people don't know, we talked about it lightly in the first episode, but we own Azure Lorica, which is a 501c3.
Nonprofit.
In those 10 years, we actually hosted a convention called NinjaCon. It was a small indie anime convention in the Los Angeles, Little Tokyo district. But one guest that I wanted forever was Frank Bedour, who's the author of The Looking Glass Wars. He's also the producer of Something About Mary, just a little sideshow and like a little side thing. He's also a champion Olympic skier. I mean, no pressure, right? This guy just does everything. We bought his said collection. I have my old first edition books from the series, but we bought the entire comic book series. Some of them are signed to Azure Lorica, some of them are signed to me.
Lovely.
But they are from NinjaCon, so I guess that would be valuable.
We'll see.
We'll see, but interesting. Okay, what's another one? Historic atlases.
Ooh. That I would actually collect, because maps are beautiful, and I mean, if anything, I know we're down to actually starting back on our collection sometime to do fantasy worlds.
Yes, and we wanted to collect maps. I have the Harry Potter map.
Yeah.
But I really want a Neverland map.
I know Neil Gaiman had one for Neverwhere.
If anyone knows a good Neverland map, please hit me up. Really.
All right.
And then I also wanted, the 500 acre wood, Winnie the Pooh, Narnia I know has a thing. I know Aragorn has a really impressive one, but we'll see.
Yeah. Any cartographers out there?
Anybody?
Help us out.
Books with backstories, it says.
Okay, so they have celebrity status.
It says
status.
Particularly 18th century, 19th centuries owned by slaves or women carrying a premium. Anything, like, it belonged to a previous something.
Ooh, like the confession books that were written by prisoners with their skin actually... Oh, is this bound?
Well, that's
to the cover.
Let's not go into detail of that. But this yes, is
so awesome. Anyways,
yeah, we'll go into that a different episode. Let us know if you want. It's a very gruesome process, but yeah. Anyways, books on domestic themes.
Come again?
Books on domestic themes. I would have never guessed.
Yeah, what?
It says look for books on cooking, cocktail recipes, household servants, and decorating homes and manners.
Okay, you want to know something about those books?
Yeah.
They never sell. They never sell.
But it says if they're vintage, then they do have a high value.
Okay. Well, that makes sense, because at least that's historical. But, like, usually when you're working in a bookstore, they never sell, so you always put them on the rack that's, like, the bargain books, or, like, you know, it's free to take.
No wonder it's hard for me to find, like, an original copy of Julia Child's, like, Art of French Cooking.
Okay, that book...
Okay, but I'm thinking that that's what he's talking about.
Okay, that makes sense. Because I remember selling that book, and I actually got caught in a bidding war between two customers. A bidding war. We had two copies, and they still went on a bidding war.
Hmm.
Like, the first one was the Julia Child, the cooking book that she wrote with the two girls, the two ladies...
Yes.
And then the other book was the one that she wrote by herself.
Right. Volume 2.
Yeah. So both of those were, like, you know, combined together were just, like, a treasure to people. So, like, and the thing was, it was two guys. And I don't
bidding.
Know. Oh, they were bidding right in front of me.
That's cool.
And I was like, what do I do? I had to call my boss. And he's like, keep going, I'll be there. You know, I'm like, whoa.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah. Because the thing is, we're not really allowed to do auctions, you know?
But it was a youth bookstore, so...
It had to be done privately.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Interesting.
We weren't permitted to do that at the premise that we were at.
Okay. Well, that is the end of the list.
Okay.
Any last thoughts?
Ouch. Because I sincerely thought I had this, you know, good, like, this perfect idea of what the industry was like. Especially,
mm-hmm.
You know, once you get into the used book industry,
mm-hmm.
like, you don't know how much people actually treasure hunt. I did not know arithmetic books were coveted that, when you actually met like a scholar, like a real college student that had like a fervor for what he is studying for, mostly they were mathematicians, they will like pay you handsomely if you could find that particular book.
Hmm.
You know, they want that in their collection. And that was like the strangest introduction I had to the whole industry, because it's a giant, like, black market.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that in itself is valuable, because this is why I said in the last episode, being a reader is more valuable than being a writer. Because as a reader, you are able to figure out what cost should a book be according to its demand, and who you are actually bidding against. Because it's a small community, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very strong community.
I think out of all this, my conclusion is, buy what makes you happy.
That's a good one, too.
Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you enough how many times I go into these used bookstores, especially like the collector bookstores, and a lot of them are collections of just people who passed away. And I mean, let's just be real here. Let's be down to earth. Nobody's gonna want your book collection. In your family. Yeah, most your family, of the time. Yeah. Nobody really knows. Unless you're one of those few awesome families, I will give you a high five right now. But yeah, buy what makes you happy. I mean, our bookshelf is one of our prized possessions. I mean, even till now, I have like really campy mangas stashed in the back, and I just know they're there, and they tell my story. I have, like, textbooks from college. I have nonprofit manuals. It's my collection.
Well, just to be, you know, devil's advocate here,
mm-hmm.
you have mixed zine mangas, not Tokyo Pop. This is like...
Oh, yes. I made it a point to collect as much Sailor Moon as possible in the original mixed zine, just because of the value of remembering it from my childhood.
Plus, the translation was way better.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, collect what makes you happy. I mean, you're the one that has to stare at it for your life, and it's your collection. I mean, it's what tells your story when yeah. people walk in. I mean, how personal is a library? Like, a personal library. It's super personal. Like, yeah. I don't care how many you see on Instagram or Pinterest. Like, they all have completely different stories, and they're all different. I mean, that's why they're so unique and why people, like, love staring at them for so long. You know, you can just keep going and going, and there's so much variety to them.
And the thing is, like, if ever you guys question whether your collection is valid or not, you gotta start questioning why you started collecting in the first place. Because you don't become a reader because it's a fad. You know? You become a reader because it's essential. But you build your collection because you start loving what those books actually mean to you.
Right. So. We would love to hear what's in your collection. As we mentioned earlier, this is Bibliosinensis. It's AT and book-driven conversation. Eugene and myself are having a conversation right now, but we'd love to get you involved. So there will be a link on this page as to how to contact us. We'd love to hear from you. For any further information, please go to bibliosinensis.com. We will have some blogs as well as links to those articles mentioned and that list. We are currently drinking Phoenix. Phoenix is available to order on tspectral.com. And we are also working on a charity drive. Did you want to bring that up? We brought it up in the first episode.
We're trying to raise $5,000 to help the Elevation Society reduce the count of suicide.
Yes.
It's been stagnant for... since 2017, but we'd like to keep it that way.
Yes. So, Azure Lorica, As we mentioned before, we believe in connecting communities with their respective craftsmen and creators. And one way we do that is we give people a safe space to do that. So we're all about anti-bullying and social issues, particularly in, like, at this point, suicide prevention.
Yeah.
Elevation Society has spoken at the Fan Film Awards at one point, and they did such a great job. It's so personal. It's actually led by a young lady that founded it because her best friend died of suicide, and she noticed the signs were there but didn't know how to discuss it. So it is her mission to go out and create conversation and equip people with friends and family that may have suicidal tendencies and how to deal with that and how to address it in a non-threatening, loving way. So we are in the works of raising money for that. Please check bibliosinensis.com for further details. Until then, we hope to hear from you soon. May your pages be long and indulging, and may your tea stay steeped and cozy.
Cheers.
Cheers.